injury lawyers Mike Riley and John Walsh.
John and I approach personal injury cases in the same way. We want to be certain that our clients are treated fairly, that our clients are comfortable, that our clients know they can trust us to get the best result for them.
It's our professional responsibility to make certain you are fairly and fully compensated. Most of our cases are settled without a trial.
Call injury lawyers Mike Riley and John Walsh at 257-5661 for the personal attention you deserve.
Welcome to another podcast. It's Sly's... Let's try that again. Welcome to another podcast at Sly'sOffice.com, brought to you by the United Steelworkers and great local sponsors like Madison Computer Works. Joining us now from the Capital Times and the Nation, John Nichols. John, how are you?
Groovy, man. I'm glad our president has been really kind of reined in by the new White House chief of staff.
Oh, he's been reined in?
You remember how last week everybody was like, oh, yeah, General Kelly, he's a really organized, you know, military disciplined kind of guy. He's really going to get, you know, things at the White House in order and, you know, he's going to crack the whip on Trump.
Mm-hmm.
And I just noticed Mr. Trump on a little bit of a Twitter tear.
Oh, that's new. I haven't seen today's Twitter tear.
Oh, yeah. And I'm just thinking maybe General Kelly, I'm not sure if it's totally working out.
I'm not sure there is any controlling Donald Trump.
There isn't.
You know, I watched part of a documentary. There's a show on Canadian television called The Passionate Eye. I don't know who originally produced this, but it really was the story of Donald Trump and his father and his grandfather. And you understand a whole lot more after watching this documentary of what shaped his moral compass.
Am I right in thinking that his father may not have been, you know, up for any of the civil rights awards?
I would say he makes, he makes Joe Kennedy look like Martin Luther King. How would that be?
I think that's actually a pretty apt, you know, assessment there.
Yeah.
Do you know something I read the other, that quite fascinated me? This is a really interesting thing. Because one thing is, whenever somebody says, well, you have to see it in the context of the times, run screaming from the room, right? Because what they're going to tell you is that somebody was like really racist or sexist or somehow horrible because that was just how things were then, you know, and neglecting the reality that there were people trying to do the right thing. And so it was a matter of courage rather than you know, circumstance.
Yeah. And, I remember I told you the story of what George Wallace did to his wife.
that's too awful. But here, I just want to tell you this quick story. It's a very interesting one because you know who James Farley was?
James Farley. Was he somebody around here?
No, he was Franklin Roosevelt's postmaster general.
Oh, no.
And he like the guy who doled out the postmaster jobs, right? And he was the chairman of the Democratic National Committee and the chairman of the New York State Democratic Party. And even he probably didn't mind the use of the term hack. Okay. He was Roosevelt's political kind of insider party sort of guy. Very, very critical to Roosevelt building out what became the New Deal coalition. And you're like, well, how did that happen? Why was Farley so successful in kind of extending the Democratic Party? Well, one of the interesting things is that in the 1920s, because he was a hack, he was put on the New York State Athletic Commission, the Boxing Commission. And because he worked the neighborhoods, because he worked the precincts, he knew that something that really bugged, really angered African-American voters who are an emerging bloc in New York State was the fact that white boxers wouldn't box against African-American champions, right? So African-Americans could never get to the championship because whites wouldn't box them.
Uh-huh.
And so he used his position on the commission to basically threaten the whole boxing industry if they didn't start opening it up. And that was almost lost to history, but it was a huge deal that he stood for civil rights in athletics in the 1920s. And the only reason I bring that whole thing up is that I think if you look at Trump's dad in the same city,
uh-huh,
at the same time, I'm not sure that he was taking that stand. And so the final element of this is James Farley, I don't think, was ever held up as a paragon of virtue, as like the best person ever. But what he did was he recognized right from wrong. He recognized the character of the times. He recognized that people had a legitimate complaint, and he acted on it. Whereas the history of the Trump family, it seems to be one of resistance to acting upon legitimate concerns.
Fred Trump Jr., who passed away because of addiction to alcohol and drugs, was evidently kind of a black sheep in the family in that he had a heart. And he had
a nice guy
who kind of was taking over for his father, beginning to get involved in the family business, hated it. And the tenants in this apartment building were cold. It was drafty. So he had all new windows put in the apartment complex. Well, that made Fred Trump Sr. very, very, very unhappy. And that was kind of the beginning of the end of Fred Trump Jr. And that was Donald Trump's ascendancy.
That's a very, very awful story.
Yes.
Somehow, yeah. I think in our ruminating tales that we're telling here, we're getting to a point that ought not be missed.
Here he is.
Donald Trump didn't start the way Donald Trump did. He was shaped
along the way. Well, I will say his father was really something. When they sent him off to Donald Trump to military school, Fred Trump Sr. wanted to make sure that his son had female companionship because there were no girls at the school. So Fred Trump and his wife would literally bring women to make sure that Donald Trump had companionship on the weekends. They'd literally drive the women to the military school.
I'm going to run screaming from the room now.
Oh, it's a great... I will... somehow I'll find a way to transfer this to a format that you can play. It's quite the illuminating documentary. Here is David K. Johnston, someone that you know, talking about Donald Trump.
This is someone who has been in public life for many years, and he's been the subject of a lot of attention. And he has run into problems with civil suits. He's been fined, but he never has had any criminal convictions, never been indicted over any sort of financial irregularities. And there's something to be said for living your life in the spotlight that long and not bringing down the law upon you, right?
Well, yes. I once had Harry Collodorus, the mob's number two hitman in the Western U.S., in my home and telling me about the people he killed, which the FBI and local cops backed up his stories. And Harry was very proud of the fact he'd never been arrested for all his crimes. Many people who cheat and swindle and steal, as Donald has done, never get arrested. That's not a measure of anything.
So this cult...
I thought you'd enjoy that.
Is that an example of slipping the knife in?
Man, twisting it real deep.
Yeah. I think I told you, I hope I've got this right. It's a long time ago, but about 25 years ago, I was down in South Texas, and I saw a campaign ad on television where a guy running for sheriff said, "Unlike my opponent, I am not currently under indictment." And it always struck me that is one of the more interesting characteristics of our politics, that we somehow imagine that the fact that you've eluded criminal prosecution makes you virtuous. Whereas when I was a little kid learning about the presidency, it's funny, they didn't say, George Washington was never convicted.
That is very true, because although I guess there was tacit admission of guilt when Richard Nixon accepted Gerald Ford's pardon. Richard Nixon had his full voting rights at his death.
Yeah, that's fine, I guess.
But it didn't make him an ethical man.
No, I actually believe those who been convicted of crime should get their voting rights back. So even I would have given them to
Now, my point was
even if he hadn't been,
the voting. Really, the voting part really wasn't my point. My point is that he wasn't a convicted. Yeah, I actually believe people while they're incarcerated should have voting rights. And they do in Canada, by the way.
Yeah. Well, so in Germany, it's a requirement of prison wardens that, or one of the job descriptions that you get high turnout among the incarcerated.
Here is the funniest comedy that's on television right now. It is the Sean Hannity television show. This is Sean Hannity with their disgraced weekend anchor and attorney, Greg Jarrett.
You have Greg, gone into great detail about what Mueller's doing. Okay, you talked about collusion, no evidence. Conspiracy to defraud, no evidence. Election violations, no evidence. Now we Trump meeting with the Russian lawyer, no evidence. Is there a lot more evidence on the list of issues I bring up every night?
With Hillary Clinton? Absolutely.
Hillary, a Ukrainian embassy, unmasking, leaking intelligence?
Debbie Wasserman Schultz, the
Thank
list
you.
Goes on and on and on.
There's much more evidence on those issues.
Oh, absolutely. You know, isn't it interesting that Robert Mueller, who is tasked with finding a crime that doesn't exist under the law, immediately impaneled a grand jury, and yet James Comey, who spent a year investigating Hillary Clinton for her email and potential pay-to-play, we believe, never impaneled a grand jury. Sean, what does that suggest to you? That the fix
Politics.
Was in? I mean, one wonders. And that, according to the House Judiciary Committee, must be the subject of an investigation by a second special counsel.
Thank you both. I'm just going to tell this audience, pay attention. We are way ahead of the media curve on this.
Way ahead, John.
I got an idea. Another reason why they may not have impaneled the grand jury, because maybe there wasn't sufficient evidence to do so.
Well,
call me crazy.
Right. I actually do believe that the former first lady was being a little more cooperative than Donald Trump. I'm not holding her up.
What was it? How many hours did she do before the congressional committee?
Right.
But one other element of this, just as long as we're throwing this in here, it's intriguing to me that I just saw a thing the other day. So he was saying, you know, that they're sort of shocked that Hillary Clinton is, you know, speaking so much about faith and religion, you know, now that she's not a presidential candidate. And I've interviewed Hillary Clinton. I've seen her in a lot of settings. I am not the biggest fan of Hillary Clinton. I'm not the biggest fan of the Clintons. But they've always talked about faith and religion. And so it's striking to me that now it's bizarre that the right is so obsessed with the Clintons that they're actually now discovering things that they never noticed during 40 years of the Clintons in politics. I mean, it's sort of, I mean, what next? Are they going to become obsessed with Adlai Stevenson?
Well, I will say with a caveat, there are some conservatives that are not obsessed with the Clintons. I don't think Jeff Flake is obsessed with the Clintons
But you could say it in a different way.
Why?
Right? You could say it in a different way. There are some Republicans who are apparently sane.
Well, there are some. there are some. All right, one more. As long as we're sort of making this segment all about morality, and this is kind of a fun frivolous day today. The latest Fox host to be suspended last year, the year before, talking about Anthony Weiner.
Sick human being to continue to do this time and time again, continue to get caught, saying he's not going to do it again, gets caught again. He is an absolute pathological, maybe.
In spite of the grammar there, here's a woman named Carolee Heldman, who is a frequent Fox News contributor, who evidently Bowling tried to sexually harass or did sexually harass Listen to this.
It was part of the culture. It was part of the environment. I worked at Fox from 2008 until 2011, and it was definitely something that was accepted. So I actually experienced it from three different men, and I also frequently experienced it from guests who would come into the green room. And as I noted on my Facebook post, I think a lot of the makeup artists are also, and people who can't speak up, who would lose their job because their contract people, they experience this pretty routinely at Fox. As Andrea Tanteros put it, it was the Wild West of sexual harassment. I think the fact that...
you know, Bob Guccione could have shot the movie Caligula in those studios, for God's sake.
It's not sounding good, is it? You know, I mean...
Yeah, how do you like that arcane point of reference?
Yeah, well, not for you, it's not arcane. no, it's an interesting thing because, you know, at the same time you bring this up, you know, like all this stuff, trouble at Fox, did you notice that, they're starting this Trump TV real news thing, you know?
Oh, are they back to that?
Yeah. Oh. And it's like...
Is that out of St. Petersburg?
No, it's out of Trump Tower, I think.
Oh, same thing.
But the weird thing about it is that... it's sort of like Fox isn't getting embarrassing even to the Trump people, which is quite amazing.
Well, Eric Bolling's one of Donald Trump's favorites.
Well, you know, he's got a lot of
things. That
network still delivers for him.
Stand by. We'll talk more with John Nichols from the Capital Times and the Nation at SlysOffice.com. Summer is usually a great time for food choices for people in Wisconsin. Backyard gardens, farmers markets, grocery stores brimming with fresh produce. But for a lot of people, they don't have those choices because school is not in session. A lot of kids get their nutrition during the school year, so we need your help. St. Vincent de Paul has a food pantry that gives your neighbor in need some of the same choices you have. But to keep it going, we need your help, your donations, support the food pantry. And you can do one of a couple things. Drop off an extra bag of groceries from the store or your local farmer's market. Also, a $50 cash donation feeds a family of five for a week. You can organize a food drive, whatever it takes to keep that food pantry going this summer while the kids are at home. Let's do what we can. Here's what you do. You contact St. Vincent de Paul at svdpmadison.org. That's svdpmadison.org. Let's work on this together. John Nichols with us from the Capital Times and the Nation at SlysOffice.com. John, I'm wondering if you wanted to comment about Jefferson Beauregard Sessions threatening the press.
Yeah, it was pretty amazing. All I can tell you is I've got this book coming out at the end of the month. And it's titled Horsemen of the Trumpocalypse, and it's profiles of all of Trump's appointees and minions. And the chapter on Sessions begins, what can be said about Jefferson Beauregard Sessions III that hasn't already been said by Dr. David Duke?
Ooh.
And, you know, the fact is, Jeff Sessions is a horrible, horrible person. He's not he's a bad person ideologically, you know, somebody you disagree with ideologically or that you have a partisan difference with the guy or something like that. He's a very, 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 very bad person. And I often wrestle with the question of, you know, how should I feel about him not getting along with Trump? Like, you know, like in this gang war, which side do you be on? And the truth of the matter is, as horrible as Donald Trump is, whenever anyone suggests, you know, well, Jeff Sessions, at least he's got dignity, or at least he's, you know, he's not tweeting or whatever terrible thing Trump is doing, I'll just remind you, Jeff Sessions' default position on any fundamental issue is authoritarian. It is to lock up dissenters. It is to diminish democracy. The guy is a horrible, horrible player who tried to put civil rights activists, close allies, people who worked closely with Dr. King, in jail for registering people to vote.
Well, doesn't he kind of have to live up to his namesake?
Which of them? Yeah, you know, there's a couple. You mean Jeff?
President Jeff. So he appears to be trying to curry favor from the president. But, you know, the truth is that they've so confused this, the leaking of intelligence, because much of what has been leaked hasn't been classified intelligence. It's been gossip out of the White House.
Oh, no. Remember Scaramucci, the stuff that got leaked about him? Remember that?
Yeah.
That was stuff that was publicly available.
Right.
I mean, to the extent that there was a leak, it says somebody said, oh, look there.
And you'll remember he accused Reince Priebus of releasing Scaramucci's background check. And, of course, that was available to the public.
Well, here's a question I have for you about Reince Priebus, as long as you mentioned him.
I miss him.
I miss him terribly, but you may see him soon. But here's a little something I'm going to throw in the mix. When Reince Priebus was left on the tarmac, the vehicle he was in eventually went back to the White House.
He did
those interviews from the White House.
Right.
And he said, I'm going to be around here a few weeks cleaning things up.
Uh-huh.
So help me with this concept. Scaramucci is definitely out of the White House.
Uh-huh.
But Reince Priebus, who was sort of shuffled out, is still there.
Right.
Like, what kind of horrible thing is that? You know, is that like... That's like a purgatory.
Well, it's, you know, it is interesting because the White House is filled with people that Reince Priebus brought with him over to the from the RNC.
Not as many. Spicer's gone.
There are plenty of people whose names you'll never hear. I guess there's a lot of people over there that he brought to.
Yeah. As long as we're there, let me just stick with you on this one. Okay, help me on this one. So Scaramucci said at a certain point, yeah, I got a whole bunch of people in the press office I'm getting ready to fire, right? But then he got fired. So was he able to fire them? And so if they're still there, are they, you know, kind of like Scaramucci fired? Like, can they stay now?
It's a really interesting,
philosophical question.
Right.
Of the Trump era.
This is from this weekend on MSNBC, and evidently there was some sort of dust-up about Kamala Harris. Here's Joy Reid talking about it.
What happened this week, guys, is that on Monday, there was a Mike.com article that went up, the headline of which was Rising Star Kamala Harris Has a Bernie Land Problem. It quoted several people, including Winnie Wong, who co-founded People for Bernie, who's saying her recent anointing is extremely telling. These donors will line her coffers, and she'll had the next 2 years to craft a message of broad appeal, blah, blah, blah. She was very upset that she was getting all this treatment. Then you have Ryan Cooper come out in an article in The Week on Thursday saying similar things, saying why leftists don't trust Kamala Harris, Cory Booker, and Deval Patrick. Look at that headline. Three people of color, three black Democrats, Kamala Harris is black and Asian American, and saying they are the problem, which set off a whole thing, Zerlina. You had a lot of people get involved. Yes. Sam Sinyanwe tweeted a tweet storm about it. He got attacked.
Right.
By several people. And then Brittany Packnett came to his defense and said, wait a minute, I was in meetings, too, with Bernie Sanders, and he had issues talking about race. Right. So now you have the two sides backfighting again. What is happening here?
Well, I think that the ideological purity that some Bernie Sanders supporters want to implement in the Democratic Party is really a manifestation of privilege, because people of color and women who are running for office can't abide by purity tests because of the structural difficulties in running for office. And the bottom line here is you need money to win an election. And if Kamala Harris needs to talk to some big money donors in order to win an election so that we can overturn Citizens United, because you can't do that unless you win an election, I'm not opposed to that.
What percentage point did Kamala Harris get elected by?
About a bazillion.
So let me ask a rhetorical question.
Another Democrat.
That's right. If I criticize Barack Obama for blowing off public financing, am I acting with white privilege?
Oh, gosh, I don't know. Sorry.
What
I can tell you is that I think that, let me put it another way, I'm not sure Barack Obama's going to be too bothered if you criticize him.
I'm not sure if you're taking a shot at him or me there.
I think it's more you.
Okay.
But as a friend. But this is an important thing to understand. in this discourse. Kamala Harris was elected because she was the more progressive Democrat running in California. She was elected as the progressive. And it doesn't mean that she's right on every issue. It doesn't mean she's going to be perfect on every issue. People can criticize.
Whatever that means, right?
From different backgrounds have criticized her from many, many different perspectives. And the same goes with other folks. Now, here's where I do think, here's the problem I've got. I think some of the people who are criticizing Kamala Harris at this point are being too petty, right? I actually have been very, very impressed with her. Like, you know, kind of, I think some of her questioning and hearings on appointees has been fantastic. And so I differ with the criticism. However, if somebody wants to criticize her, you know, yeah, I think she is a very strong, super smart, super skilled political figure who has come up, you know, in some very competitive, very difficult settings. I think she's going to do as she chooses, and she's going to do well.
Let me take the airplane up 10,000 feet here.
Okay.
For people that feel a little threatened that suddenly there's going to be the people that supported Clinton and Obama, some of the Wall Street crowd are going to get behind Kamala Harris as a vehicle to snuff out some of the stuff Bernie is trying to bring into the Democratic Party. I think they're maybe projecting on her, and maybe it isn't fair. I don't know that much about her. Identity politics is a replacement for progressive politics in the Democratic Party.
That's an absurd construct. I understand that you know it is.
But you understand what I'm saying. They're worried that again the Democratic Party is going to go with, well, let's face it, Hillary Clinton got the nomination because she was a woman. Right? Am I wrong?
I think that Hillary Clinton got the nomination because she was backed by the powerful infrastructure of the Democratic Party. I think that she benefited to some extent from the fact that people were excited about the first woman nominee.
Well, I think that's what I said.
And that's a good, yeah, but that's a good thing. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. Here's where I think you're getting to, and I think this is an important thing to understand. Political skills, political talent, and the ability to kind of capture the moment, you know, will reside in people from many different backgrounds and with many different skills. The challenge that the Democratic Party at this point has is that it desperately, desperately, desperately needs to become a party that is speaking to the 21st century, not kind of being nostalgic, not, you know, trying to, you know, reconstitute the, you know, whatever Franklin Roosevelt did. And, you know, it needs to get its act together in a whole bunch of ways. One of the places where it has its act together has been a concern about advancing women, advancing people of color, advancing members of the LGBTQ community, you know, really being a reflection of America. That's one of the great things about the Democratic Party. And it's going to get them a long way. It's a valuable thing.
Republicans have very successfully exploited that plus and turned it into a negative for a lot of people that are feeling resentful and left behind.
Well, but here's the answer. Then you take that positive of promoting diversity and you link it with big ideas, big plans, a big approach. And the fact of the matter is, there's tremendous evidence that grassroots Democrats will back a candidate who's got the big ideas, who's got the big plans. And whether it's man or woman, whether it's person of color, white person, whatever, there's a tremendous evidence that will come together. But if you don't have the big plans, if you don't have the big ideas, it can fall apart.
Well,
I'll give you a very good example. Let me just give you the example of Walworth County.
We're almost out of time here.
Barack Obama, 48% of the vote in Walworth County, just about carried it. Hillary Clinton, 37% of the vote in Walworth County, got wiped out. Same amount of voting, same stuff. So, I mean, it's clearly super talented candidates with an idea that captures the moment, they can win. But if you're not capturing the moment, if you're not hitting that right message, you can get beat.
All I can say is I feel pretty burned by the last two Democratic presidents. And I think there are a lot of people that live in cities that are progressives that have done pretty well economically, never understood that part of the Democratic coalition has been left behind, and the Democratic Party thought they could skate by another election with doing this two-step with Wall Street, and they were wrong.
I think you are very right about that. I think that's the future, and I think that's what I mean. Democratic, these people who try to make a fight between embracing diversity and being about economic justice seem to forget that the person who really in the modern era brought an economic justice message into the Democratic Party that reasserted it and fought off the DLC Wall Street types was Jesse Jackson. And so
that is very
true.
The fact
of the matter is I reject this notion. I totally reject this notion that somehow you've got to have, you know, you got to sacrifice something on one side. No, no. I think the key is to put these two sides together and to have fights over that.
But the truth is the Joy Reids of the world will never understand that some of Barack Obama's more terrible policies hurt African Americans as much as they did white working class men.
I believe Cornel West has said that.
John Nichols from the Capital Times and The Nation. Thanks for coming to SliceOffice.com.